Kizer Khan can't go anywhere without being noticed. People hold doors for him, cry when they see him, even jump out of cars to hug him. He became known around the world after his short speech at the Democratic National Convention. He spoke about his son, Army Captain Humayun Khan, a war hero killed in Iraq in 2004. And then Mr. Khan took a pocket constitution out of his sports coat and challenged Donald Trump.
Have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Since that moment, Kizer Khan has appeared a lot on TV and gotten both support and criticism. And he's still going. Kizer Khan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your pocket constitution is now such a famous thing. I think it's important to say you are an attorney. You went to Harvard Law School. When did you start carrying a pocket constitution?
It's many, many years ago. I'm fond of Thomas Jefferson and the Constitution. I used to read it in book form, and then I discovered that there is such a thing as pocket-sized constitution. So I acquired a few copies, and just as a conversation starter at home, whenever some dear guests would come to home, especially foreign guests, I would give them always a copy of the Constitution.
Really?
And that would, we still do.
Really?
And so since then, I started to keep it because it has certain provisions that I wanted to make sure that I read them correctly, that I have memorized them, and I begin to read. So it began to stay in my coat pocket all the time. I even have it right now. I'm holding
okay.
it. And it is all worn out, and there are marks and, you know, highlights and added terms on it and all. So that's how I begin to keep a copy of it in my pocket. University of Virginia ROTC cadets come to our home each year just to pay tribute and meet us. Their former commander said to New York Times that whenever we go to Kizer Khan and Ghazala Khan's home, the very first thing they do is they provide a copy of the Constitution to cadets. What it is a gesture. It's a symbol. It's a reminder to them that in a few days you will be taking an oath to protect this document. To some, it means a lot. To some, it means just a gift. To some, it means just a book. We leave that to their decision, but it means so much to us. Every word of it has a tremendous meaning for us.
What is a, you know, amendment or passage or sentence that means the most to you? I mean, could you read something?
You're going to make me cry if I read it. I swear it has a tremendous impact on me, and it's the 14th Amendment, which is civil rights. The 14th Amendment was proposed on June 13, 1866, and ratified on July 9th. 1868. And Section 1 says, I apologize if I lose my composure when I read these words. It just has such an impact on me, but I'll read it. I'll try to gain strength and I'll try to read it. Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state shall make law or enforce any law which shall abridge the privilege and immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of law. These last four or five words mean so much to me. And I invite your audiences to look at these few words, not just look at them. Try to understand the impact of these four or five words in our life today. Each and every citizen of this country, men, women, children, immigrants, Muslims, Hindus, all religions, all faiths, all genders, everybody is impacted by these four, five words of the Constitution.
Thank you so much. It's very moving. So was it your idea to take out the Constitution that night on that stage? No.
That is why I say that this was, that decision was made somewhere else. I was just used to do that. The original words in the speech that my wife trimmed, I had six pages, and the convention said, you only have 3 minutes. And so I began to count words and read to her, and she said, don't say this. This is beyond our position there. This is beyond the dignity of the occasion and all that. So she trimmed it, and we came to about 1.5 pages. And then again, further, it was trimmed. So my original language of referencing the Constitution was, have you read the Constitution of the United States? If you do, look for the words liberty and equal protection of law. So I'm ready, and I have put it in my head and one piece of paper, and we are getting ready. Got ready in the hotel, headed to the cab. They had instructed us to make sure that there are no coins, keys, and metal in your pockets and all. And so I'm doing last check after I put my coat on, which is the last thing I put in while preparing to go to the convention. And I feel this something in my left side coat pocket. And I looked at it, and it was Constitution that I have always kept in my coat pocket. So I said, well, this couldn't be a threat to the security, and there's no metal in it. So I got in the cab, and I showed it to my wife. I said, look, this is the Constitution in my pocket, and I'm referencing it. Why don't I pull it out? She said, oh, well, if you want to pull it out, make sure that the front side comes front, because the back side is nothing but just the blank blue page, and that wouldn't mean anything. So we are sitting, and the cab is running towards the convention, and I'm putting it this way. I'll pull out this way, and then I'm practicing it, put it this way, and put it this way.
Oh, you practiced. Wow.
In the cab. So it was meant to be, because I didn't decide to carry it from home. I could have had any other coat, and this would be sitting at home, and so...
So it happened to be in that coat, and you just thought, well, we'll pull it out.
Yeah, that's right. And I am so delighted. I am so grateful to the decency of America that now it has become symbol of protest. Any meeting that Donald Trump goes, people have begun to put, because it has gotten into their pockets now. They are showing it to him. They are waving at him and all. So,
when you walked off the stage that night, you must have thought, okay, we've done what we came here to do. It's over. What was the moment you realized it's not over? This is going to keep going.
I have been unable to comprehend it. When we got off the stage, we walked down towards the operations section. I was so concerned about Ghazala's health, because she was about to fall apart. It took her amazing strength to remain standing there. And she did begin to sob after we were away from the lights, and there were steps to go, and there were corners to turn. And I was so concerned that I asked the staff that was there that if they would help us to walk to the green room so she can sit down and console herself and compose herself.
Sure.
So those were the thoughts, and I remained concerned up until the telephone began to ring. And next morning, I realized that it may have touched a heart or two.
But when did you realize that this was going to keep going and keep going and keep going through many, many news cycles?
That was over the weekend. But I had realized it immediately when we got to the hotel where we were. The staff of the hotel came out from behind the counter, two wonderful ladies, and they had, once they came out, several other people came out. And from there up until today, up until just a few moments ago before I came to the studio, that this theme had been same. Everybody comes up, encourages us, expresses their condolence and their sympathy and all that. In that conversation, when I look at their faces, every person, regardless of age, gender, ethnicities, they have tear in their eyes. The small gesture had touched so many hearts. I just came to studio and I was crossing. I had my head down because that's the only way I can protect myself and walk and go wherever I'm going. Because when we were in D.C., we couldn't get out to get a cup of coffee. Lobby, coffee shop, restaurant, streets, corners. We want to take a picture with Ghazala, with me. Words of encouragement, words of love and sympathy. A car pulls up next to me and the driver shouts my name. I pause and two young ladies, and these are Virginians, two young ladies jump out of the car right in the middle of the street and they hug me, they give me a hug. And these are about, I guess, 15, 16-year-old
wow.
young ladies. And they say to me, they're looking at me, and they say to me, I say, we are so proud of you. You made all of us proud. What they are saying, in fact, is that not only this generation, even the coming generation had been touched and had been realized that this is a wonderful country with exceptional values. We should be so proud of it. We should protect it with our lives. We should protect it, make it better. Should we be concerned about its safety and security? Of course. Of course we should be. We should make our laws stricter. We should make our laws more comprehensive. But in that process, we should help each other, hold each other's hand so that we can make it safer.
Not everybody has been supportive. And like I said, we're not going to go over the this and that, the things that people said and how do you respond. But surely you have a different perspective on this country after this week. What have you learned?
Not at all. Really, there is no new perspective. I have been a believer in those good values, good tradition, good foundation, always. So there is nothing new. The only thing new is that how can I express my gratitude to the people that have extended their support, their love, their care, criticism. Of course, it's understood when a person stands for something, the better it is, the more criticism you will receive. That is a natural process. That is history of human behavior. So I am concerned for the safety of me and my family, but the right precautions had been in place, and I want to utter it so that people are aware of it, that all the phone calls and all the hate mails, it's being kept and it's being placed in right hands so that, God forbid, if somebody dared to violate the law, it's intact. And but the overwhelming, I have been contacted by all four corners of the world to speak, to talk, to tell them the same story. Lots of telephone calls from the languages that I cannot speak, that I have not been able to speak. I am not versed in Spanish, but I have spoken on their radios, and the response of their audience had been just pouring of love.
Do you have any regrets? I mean, is there anything you would do differently as you look back on this week of media appearances and just this constant outpouring of either love or hate?
I will do it million times. I will do it louder. I will do it forcefully. I will ask the convention to give me time for my 6 pages of a speech. They put restriction and they minimized it, and that's all I could say. But I will do it. I'm glad you asked that question. I'll do it 100 million times. It's the time. Now is the time for the rest of the world to see the true America, the decent America, the good America. Somehow, some of political pandering and Donald Trump's rhetoric had put a bad name to my country, and I will stand to correct it. I will do it a million times.
You had mentioned this week that you were planning to go back to visit your son's grave at Arlington Cemetery. Have you been back since the convention?
Yeah. I was there, and I was just amazed that not at his burial, there were so many flowers and so many people. Since when I was there, the Arlington Cemetery staff came to me and they said, because they recognized who I was, and they came and they said, Mr. Khan, there had been so many people coming to the section of the cemetery. They ask us, where is Captain Humayun Khan buried? We want to go and pay tribute.
Oh.
Equal number that people used to go to was Eternal Flame. They go there, and then the next stop is Humayun's gravesite.
Wow, that must feel like a very huge honor.
It is an honor. It is an honor. And his grace, and you know, when you do something for others, to your detriment, but for the good of others, the way he sacrificed his life, that grace continues to shine. All these words and events and this public reception of us as his parents and all, this is all under that grace of caring for others. It doesn't have to be that everybody has to wear the uniform and has to fight the war. Not at all. Even ordinary citizen walking on the street, as long as that care of other is in their heart, they are blessed. They are under that grace that has blessed us and had made us stronger.
You know, I think about him choosing a life of service, and it's, I mean, in some ways you yourself have now been thrust into a kind of life of service. How do you feel about that?
I'm delighted that behind all of this is that, could we help somebody? Could we help another human being? Could we strengthen the worried heart? Could we put some peace of mind in suffering of somebody that has been caused by xenophobic statements, by hate-mongering, by division-causing? So we will continue to do this in whatever measures it is meant to be. I have scores of invitations to come to and speak to the organization. Most prominent, to my heart, most prominent one is the New York Police Department's groups of the affected families have invited us to come and speak to one of their, and I'll be so honored to go there and just simply tell them that those who have been in their profession guarding others are the closest to our Creator, and they will always be closest to our Creator, and the people that have sacrificed their loved one to protect others are the most dignified in this life and hereafter. So they should feel proud of their relatives that have sacrificed their life in protecting others. So I am so looking forward to going there. But there are scores of other invitations that I may not be able to go, but I'm so honored.
When you went to Arlington this most recent time, what did you do there after talking to the, of course, after you talked to the people who work there?
I went to the gravesite. I did what I do all the time. I stand there quietly and I close my eyes. And I talk to my Creator.
That's between you and your Creator, I think. But I wonder if you think about your son and what he would think about all this.
Believe me, if he was around, he would be standing right next to me with his left hand on my left shoulder, because that's how we used to greet one another.
Oh.
That's where hearts are. So I don't feel that he's too far. He's right here.
Yeah. We know many things about your son. We know that he was called to serve when he was in university, and that he worked in force protection in Iraq at a base in Iraq, and that it was his day off, and he was going to check on his troops. He went out toward a taxi that, of course, would later become a suicide bomber when he was killed. What else do you think people should know about your son, things that we don't know?
He was open book. There is one incident that is so timely that I must tell you.
Sure.
At University of Virginia at Hereford, where he lived, Hereford College, that was his dorm, is a basketball court. And students will come out and play at different times, mostly in the afternoon. And there were two teams. There were teams of African-American students playing with one another, and in one side of the court, there was other section where the white American students would be playing, and this had been continuing, and Humayun would go and would try to play with both of them. He realized the tensions between the groups, and he realized that it will be so wonderful to bring them together. So he decides that we will have a match, and we will have two teams. But then he said to them that, look, there are some strong players on one side. The other team doesn't have that strong player. So we are going to mix, and we are going to take the captains from both teams, and they will select the players. And he told them that you have to have equal number from both teams. And so thereafter, they played the match, and thereafter they begin to talk to one another, begin to play with one another. And a delegation of them came to visit us after his passing, and they have placed a bench outside in the small garden, not the main Alderman Library footsteps, but on the side there is a small garden dedicated to, and there is a bench. Those students placed that bench, and they came to us and they narrated that this incident. They said that incident, that bringing us together, changed us for the rest of our lives. We carry that manner, that coming together with us all the time in our lives. And so it was that kind, gentle manner, but doing something that profoundly helps and affects others.
What have you learned about, what have you learned about yourself through all this process? Have you learned anything? Have you surprised yourself, you know? You probably didn't imagine yourself as somebody who'd be going on TV this much, right?
Yes, I can't hold my composure for too long when something close to my heart is being talked. So I begin to cry when we had an appearance at the UVA television station, and the driver came to pick us up, and this guy had no idea where he was going or who is he meeting. Ghazala and I came out, and he was holding the door, and he began to sob. He looked at us, and I hugged him. I told him, you know, that's okay. Everything will be okay. So let's get in the car before we get late. So he composed himself, and we got in the car, and he told us the story that the night of the convention, he was listening to all of the speeches and all that, casually sitting, and then my turn came, and he was listening halfway, and he got up, his three sons got up. They hugged one another, and they felt so much better after the speech. And I discovered that I cannot maintain my composure, be it radio or television or anywhere, that I am so weak inside that these things touch me so much. So,
but it sounds like maybe you're okay with that.
I'm okay. It's expression of my affection. I am in the... At the age where everybody is either my brother, sister, or my daughters and sons, so it is okay to be teary-eyed in front of them.
Well, welcome to the club. Yeah, I think it's fine, personally. You know, I know the criticism has had to be difficult. This is kind of a difficult question to ask, but...
No, ask, please.
When people say that you are politicizing the memory of your son, you know, I know what your answer is to that, that you believe in what you're doing. But does it, when they say that, does it ever give you pause? Did you, was there ever a time when you thought, you and Ghazala talked about that this is a private thing. This is something, you know, that we don't want to put out there, or maybe we shouldn't have put out there, because by putting it out there, it changes it, no matter what, right? Grief is something that is so personal, but when you put it out for the whole world, it's going to change. Has there ever been a time when you've thought, oh, I wish maybe we hadn't done that?
No, not at all, not at all. We are very deliberate people. We have discussed it, that there is going to be criticism. Generally, grief is something so very private, and it had been private for us all these years. Humayun passed away in 2004, so we are talking about 12 years, and we have kept it private. Here is our whole family sat, and when first we did not seek that we should be invited. It came to us.
Yeah.
That's one thing. I could have simply gone to the stage with Ghazala and said, thank you for your love, thank you very much, God bless, and walked out. Yeah. Convention probably would have wanted that. But
it would have been shorter.
Exactly. But nobody prompted me, nobody asked me to write this, nobody asked me to, you know, there is criticism that, oh, it may have been, I was prompted with this, and you heard the whole story, how it all came into being.
Yeah.
So I sat for hours thinking, should I use this occasion? Would this be the right time? My conscience, I will have such a burden on my conscience if I would have not spoken. In the midst of the grief, we don't set our conscience aside. There are some prices that must be paid. There are certain concerns and certain hearts that must be touched, regardless of the price. I will take up entire time of your show if I narrated the story of Rumi, how he became Rumi, what he had to give up to become Rumi for the rest of the world. Some moments come where you have to run naked on the street in the public so that somebody's heart could be hardened, somebody's concern could be addressed. That is okay. There is no shame in that. If the purpose is seeking glory, I don't go for that. If somebody can tell me that today after you spoke, the concerned children, the scared small girls and boys would be heartened, I would quietly go back to peace and quiet so that I can resume my normal life. But it's by choosing, by deliberate choosing, not accident, and it will continue to be that way. I know the price, I know the criticism, and I am firm on my decision. I have very clear conscience that someday, and I'm a strong believer, that when we appear in front of our God, I will have one thing to say about myself, that regardless of this, I prefer to comfort a scared heart.
So you have paid a price. You have paid a price.
I will continue for that. I will continue to pay the price. If the purpose is helping others, doing something that is absolutely needed, we have been quiet. We have not said a word. We have kept our grief private. And had Donald Trump conducted himself as deserving of the candidacy of the presidency, I didn't have to say anything. I am not a person of position and importance and at all. I'm a private, ordinary citizen. But his threats to 11 million Hispanic Americans, his threats to immigrants, all immigrants, to Muslim Americans, his disrespect of honorable judges, his mockery of decent women of this country. The price, my privacy, is no price at all. I can sacrifice 1 million privacies to address those concerns, to raise my voice for those concerns.
Khizr Khan, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.